From Iowa City, Iowa Public Radio presents Live from Prairie Lights, America's best writers reading from their poetry and prose from Prairie Lights Bookstore, 15 South Dubuque Street, Iowa City. The Live from Prairie Lights programs are archived on our website, wsui.uiowa.edu. You can listen to them anytime, anywhere in the world. This is Live from Prairie Lights. I'm Julie Englander. Put your life on a diet. Lessons learned living in 140 square feet. Who would do this and why? Iowa Cityan Gregory Paul Johnson lives in such a house, and in his new book, he explains why and how smaller living is healthier for one's life and for the planet. Perhaps not all of us will opt to live in a miniature house, but there are things everyone can do to simplify life. And Johnson gives us five main areas that we can think about: housing, food, technology, utilities, and transportation. Gregory Paul Johnson is the founder and director of Resources for Life, an outreach and public interest organization based in Iowa City. His study of urban and regional planning and the Higher Education Consortium for Urban Affairs included travel to several South American countries, including Panama, Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru. And he works now as a technology consultant for the University of Iowa, as well as clients served by his consulting firm, the Technology Services Resource Group. Welcome, Gregory Paul Johnson, to Live from Prairie Lights.
Thank you, Julie. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm going to start right with the house, Gregory Johnson. So in order for listeners to get a good idea, what is 140 square feet comparable to? A studio apartment or much smaller?
It's actually about the same. It's funny you'd mention the studio apartment. I was renting a studio apartment here in Iowa City. And if you've compared some of the housing costs, you know, that just actually a couple blocks away from here, you can spend about $1,000 a month on an efficiency apartment. So I had something smaller than an efficiency. I was renting about 10 by 12 room for about $300 a month. And so this house that's 140 square feet is actually small for a house, but larger than the space I was renting before.
So what does this look like? People hear you actually brought the house because it's on wheels, but who built it? Where did you, what does it look like, and how do you live in it?
Okay, so yeah, the house, what it looks like is, some people have said it looks like a garden shed or a playhouse or something like that because of its size. Its proportions are all consistent so that it does look like a miniature house. There's a front porch with railing. And the dimensions are 10 by 7. There's an upstairs loft, so that's where you get the extra 70 square feet to make the 140 square feet. It has cedar siding on the outside, looks very much like residential construction, and pine paneling on the inside. And I think what makes it really livable is that it has windows facing to the north and the south and the east and the west. So you're not really looking at a wall in front of you, you're looking at the outside. Yeah.
And I said it's on wheels, so it's very mobile. So how do you, does it hook up to water or electricity, or how do you live in this house?
Well, you know, ironically, I suppose I would like to have water, electricity. The city prohibits that, if you can imagine. If I were to have residential utilities, then the home would need to meet certain specifications and standards for housing, which, as I recall, I think it has to be 20 feet wide, and then if you want it small, you can have it has to be at least 7 feet in depth. So if you can imagine a house that's 20 feet by 7 feet, that's what the city would require. And that was kind of too much space for me, and I thought the dimensions would be sort of odd, you know, having a 20 foot by 7 foot house. So in order to avoid those requirements for housing, I had the house put on a trailer, built on the trailer permanently, by Jay Schaefer, who has been featured locally in media. And since over the last few years, he's now appeared on Oprah Winfrey and some other national media. So,
and he has this building organization that builds these small homes.
Right. Okay. The Tumbleweed Tiny House Company is his business.
How did you get started doing this, and why did you do it? Let's go a little bit further back than just your decision. And a man named Nicholas Johnson, I believe, was a big influence in your decision to outsource and downsize. So explain to people who Nicholas Johnson is.
Yeah, my dad, Nicholas Johnson, as I now retrospective, you know, look back on it, had a really big influence in some of these choices that I've made. And it wasn't until I was in the middle of writing the book And I had that realization that subconsciously I must have been thinking back on a book that he wrote back in the 70s called Test Pattern for Living. And so this book was really becoming kind of my version of, you know, how am I approaching life as far as technology and environmental decisions and transportation and health and things like that. So, yes, he had a big influence on my life. And I remember when I was younger and he would tell me about the benefits of living in an apartment. And he would share about how, you know, if something gets broken, you just call and somebody fixes it. It's not like having a home where you spend maybe 10, 20 hours a week doing the landscaping and fixing the roof or painting or something like that, that in an apartment you have that freedom to spend your time in other ways. So I've always imagined myself having that freedom either through a simple small house or an apartment. And, you know, as I looked back at times in my life when I was the happiest and had the most freedom, it was when I was living in smaller spaces, either on vacation, staying at a cottage or cabin, or just in a hotel room. There was just kind of a sparse, simple surroundings, and I had more freedom and time to do other things. So,
now, you went from 2,000 square feet to the 140 square foot home, so how difficult was it going from one to the other initially, and how long have you been living this way?
Since the year 2000.
Okay.
And I had been married before, and after getting a divorce, I was on my own again and realized, you know, I don't need 2,000 square feet anymore. So the simplest thing I could think of to do was to take everything I had and put it into storage as just kind of a first step, and then start bringing those things into my life that I needed. Rather than, you know, eliminating things, I would start with just a bed and a desk and say, okay, what am I going to go to storage today and get and bring into this space? I was renting an efficiency apartment. So I was kind of busy, and a week went by and 2 weeks went by, and I thought, oh, yeah, I've got to get over to storage and get those things that I really need. And then a month went by and 6 months went by, and then I kind of forgot. You know, I thought, what's in storage? What's over there? What do I really need? All I've been needing is just my bed and my desk and my notebook computer. And so that got me thinking about sort of downsizing and minimalism and that type of thing.
And you do call this minimalism living or minimalist living?
Yeah, I guess so, just living with fewer things.
Now, it's not only that, but it's also you're making, for the lack of a better way of putting it, a statement about how simplifying life and being kind to the environment.
Right. And I've talked to people who, you know, they see my home or they read about it, and certainly they don't go out the next week and sell everything they have and move into 140 square feet. But what I often hear is, you know, well, you inspired us to clean out our garage or to clean up the basement or to, you know, this type of thing. So it's hopefully living an example that today some people stop by to see the house and they said, you know, we thought we had a small house, but now we feel good about our house. Our house is big compared to this, you know. So hopefully it does. It's something I call lifestyle activism. There's a saying I often refer to, which is live the answer, or, you know, the answer is to live the answer. And what I mean by that is that if we just become the change we want to see, if we begin to live a more green life, choose a bicycle over a car, choose, you know, maybe a simpler vegan diet instead of a more complex and energy demanding diet, some things like that. Individually, when we make those choices, that on a macro scale, that can have a big impact.
Well, Gregory Paul Johnson, why don't you share some selections from your book, and then we'll talk more with you and invite the audience into the program. His book, Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned Living in 140 Square Feet.
Thanks, Julie. And I think what I'll do is just kind of go through the book and pick out, I chose a few topics I want to read a page or two about. I'll read the introduction and then a little bit on the environment, technology, thinking about our living space, and then the impact of bicycling. So we'll see how much time we have, and I'll just kind of pace through. For me, we're here in Iowa City, and the downtown merchants are very important to me because, you know, I depend on my bicycle. I can't be driving to Cedar Rapids or Des Moines when I want to buy something from the shopping mall. And if you think about it, we have this mixture here in Iowa City of businesses and, you know, grocery stores and restaurants and shops. And that really makes this book possible, what we're about to talk about tonight, what some people refer to as new urbanism, is where you mix up this urban space. And so without these merchants, there is no book. you know, I really value the Iowa City area, and I think people have asked me, you know, what makes this possible? And that's what makes it possible. If I were living out in the middle of Montana, or if I were living in one of these cities that is, you know, very much an automobile-based city, I might want to ride the bike, but, you know, there really are no bike paths. There's no way to get around. So Iowa City is uniquely suited for this kind of living. And, you know, maybe in part that's because of the students living in dorms who don't have all these facilities at home, so they're going to go to the fitness center, they're going to go to the park and that type of thing. But anyway, I wanted to acknowledge that before continuing on. So anyway, first I'm just going to read the introduction because that sort of sets the context for the book. I live in a home of 140 square feet. It doesn't have a furnace, air conditioner, refrigerator, dishwasher, clothes washer, dryer, vacuum cleaner, blender, disposal, trash compactor, or other home appliances. For most of my commuting, I walk or rely on bicycle year-round rather than a car. My small home is completely off the electrical and water grids. Most people would say that this is an impossible way to live, but the truth is my transition to a simpler life has made me happier and healthier than I've ever been. When we come to a certain way of thinking and living, it usually is a result of many experiences and encounters throughout life that shape us along the way. So it is with my interest in smaller living. Since I was very young, I've always had a fascination with the idea of having an efficiently designed small home. In 2001, I saw an article in the Des Moines Register about Jay Schaefer, who at the time was living in a 10 by 14 foot home he built on a trailer. The home was constructed using residential-grade materials and insulation for economical year-round habitation, something that most RVs and camper trailers lack, since they are usually designed for seasonal, part-time use. This fusion of camper and house intrigued me. I contacted the Des Moines Register to get approval for putting a copy of the article on my website with other related simple and small living resources. By 2002, I began receiving emails and phone calls from people who had seen the article about Jay Schaefer on my website. I eventually came into contact with him, and he was delighted to learn of my interest in his home. In the fall of 2002, Jay invited me to attend a presentation at the Iowa City Public Library on small and alternative homes. While I did not own a small or alternative home at the time, I was still very interested in that unique way of living. I was impressed by the presentation, and at the end of the meeting, I commented that someone should start an organization in response to the small house movement. Jay and the others at the meeting laughed and said that during dinner, they had been discussing that very same idea and thought that I would be just the person to start such an organization. So they were already familiar with some of the work I'd done through my resourcesforlife.com website. So the next day, we put together the initial modest webpage, and the Small House Society was born. Originally, I was elected, in quotes, as the leader, since I would be taking on the bulk of emails, phone calls, correspondence, expenses, and maintenance of the website. By 2003, I'd reached a point in my life where I needed a change. It didn't make sense to rent a small apartment, never putting money toward owning a home. I imagined 30 years down the road having spent thousands of dollars on rent with nothing to show for it. Once I stopped and thought about where my money was going, I began looking at my options for purchasing a small house or condo. What I discovered is that while efficiency apartments exist, efficiency condos are not readily available. Local housing codes have made it illegal to build a small efficiency house, deeming such a dwelling uninhabitable, even though an equivalent dwelling as an apartment is legal. Basically, what I wanted was the option to own a simple room, like the one I was currently renting. The solution was obvious. Not only was I impressed with people like Jay, who lived in compact, environmentally friendly homes, but I was also the head of the Small House Society. I felt strongly that it was important to be part of the small house community and reduce my environmental footprint. I worked closely with Jay Schaefer on the custom design of my house plans, and within 3 months, my home was built. While living in my compact home for the last 5 years now, I have learned that as my living space became smaller, my freedom expanded, both in terms of finances and free time. This increase in my time and money has impacted every area of my life. Eventually, I lost about 100 pounds after having been overweight for almost a decade. The weight loss was the result of working less, sleeping more, having more time to exercise, and replacing my car with a bike. I also now have extra money to join a gym and make healthier eating choices. Having more time and money allows me to give more of myself to family and friends. I've been able to expand my volunteer time and financial donations to causes I believe in. My career has deepened and expanded because I've been able to focus on professional development and pursue opportunities for growth. Rather than worrying about short-term financial needs, I've been able to pursue those things that promise long-term benefits. What excites me most about simple living is how micro decisions can have macro impact. For me, building and living in a smaller home has resulted in a significantly reduced cost of living. My home's cost of construction, utility bills, and maintenance are much lower than the cost for an average home. Living in a smaller space also puts limits on my purchases, thus saving me money. All of these factors result in having a smaller environmental footprint, which benefits everyone. While living in a home of 140 square feet, I find that I'm still using about 2,000 square feet of space, just as I had in the past. The difference is that the other 1,860 square feet that comprise my office, the gym, the laundromat, restaurants, and other spaces are not mine to maintain anymore. They're shared with others, so not only am I contributing to my community, but my overhead and responsibilities have been significantly reduced. In our complex and busy world, many people are searching for a simpler life, like prospectors panning for an elusive gold nugget. It was, in fact, the act of getting rid of my possessions that allowed me to obtain the treasure of simplicity. This book is not only a record of my journey towards simpler living, but also what I've learned on the way that can help you simplify your life. I don't expect that most people will make the extreme choice I did, but who doesn't want a life that's simply satisfying, simply fulfilling, and simply great? I put my new life on a new path and changed everything for the better. Let me help you start on your path, too. So that's the introduction. And then I'm just going to read some selections on different topics, and these will be shorter readings. On the environment, I'm just going to read here. So, and should we hold questions till the end, then? Is that, yeah. So this is a chapter on the environment. And traveling, it's chapter 5, Traveling Green. And there's a quote, there are quotes sprinkled throughout the book, and the quote beginning this chapter is, "He who would travel happily must travel light." In 1989, after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, all fingers were pointing to Exxon and placing the blame where one might expect it. Surprisingly, Greenpeace launched an advertising campaign showing a photograph of the man in charge of the ship, Captain Joseph Hazelwood. Beneath his photo was the caption, "It wasn't his driving that caused the Alaskan oil spill. It was yours." That advertisement had an impact on me, perhaps because I was one who was quick to point the finger at Exxon without realizing or acknowledging my own participation in the spill. However, after seeing that ad, I realized that my own demand for oil was partly to blame for the spill. Yet, knowing this, I couldn't really think of any alternative to an automobile because I was dependent on my car to live. My work depended on me driving. The only change I could foresee making was a gradual, long-term change in my life about how I would use transportation. I remember the day my dad told me that he could go from Iowa City to Des Moines, about 100 miles, in less time riding a bicycle than it would take me driving a car. I'd grown accustomed to my dad thinking outside the box, but this statement just seemed too unbelievable. Then I listened as he explained his reasoning. The time it takes to get somewhere in a car must include the operating cost of that vehicle and the time required on the job to earn the money for the purchase. He also explained that the time spent maintaining the car should also be considered, even while under warranty. If it costs 50 cents per mile to operate a vehicle, then a 100-mile ride in the car takes about 2 hours in transit, and the amount of time required to earn the money, the $50 to pay for the operation of the vehicle, and a portion of the time spent maintaining the car. For most people, it might take a day or more to earn $50 after taxes. So someone starting out on their bicycle at 10 miles an hour could leave Iowa City and arrive in Des Moines before a person could earn the money required to drive there. For this reason, the top speed of most automobiles is about 10 miles per hour, since the more expensive the car, the slower it goes, because we have to pay for it longer. Because of our instant gratification culture, we're sheltered from these realities. Imagine if everyone were required to save up money to purchase a vehicle. If that were the case, we'd realize that the first mile we drive our new car actually takes about 3 to 5 years to drive that first mile. Walking that mile would take about 20 minutes. Obviously, in rush hour traffic and gridlock, driving a car is even less efficient. It's not just the cost of a new vehicle we should consider, but also the opportunity cost of investing $20,000 to $30,000 in a depreciating asset, rather than investing that money in a business or some interest-bearing account. How much is your vehicle costing you? If you really consider the cost of payments, insurance, gas, oil changes, repairs, tires, emissions, parking, the cost of owning an automobile is probably $300 to $400 a month for most people. What would you do with that kind of money left over each month? For me, part of simple and small living involves simplicity in transportation. I very much want my choice of daily transportation to be as simple, small, and environmentally responsible as my home. So I sold my car on Earth Day in 2004 and began using a bike full-time, year-round. Two technologies make this possible, a good rain suit and a bike trailer for hauling larger loads. On the rare occasion that I need to use a car for out-of-town travel, I simply borrow or rent one, which over time ends up being much less expensive than owning a car. When I decided to live in a small house, I didn't want to make arrangements to store and maintain a car, so I decided that riding a bicycle year-round would be the way to go. Riding a bicycle is quiet, it saves time, money, and space, it doesn't pollute. Riding a bicycle is better for my community, the environment, and for me. So that's just a little bit about transportation. And then, you know, an important chapter in this book, I think a lot of people think of the book as being about housing and smaller spaces, but there's a lot more to it. I talk about health in here, and as you just heard, a little bit about transportation and such, but technology. And that's my field of interest. It's what I've been doing for the last 25 years. So I'm going to read a couple of pages in here about technology. And the chapter on technology is titled, Technology is Shrinking Our Lives. Okay. And this section is Going Digital. I've come to see technology as a wonderful means for downsizing my living space. As we increasingly enter into an information age, more of our possessions take on a digital form. Think about your own purchases over the last couple of years. Maybe you've gone from buying music on CDs to purchasing downloaded music online. Are you someone who goes online to receive bank statements and pay bills? Is your photography collection now inside your computer rather than in photo albums on shelves? Is your list of names and phone numbers in your cell phone rather than written in a book? These are all examples of how individuals are slowly transforming the information in their lives from physical form into digital. And as a result of this trend, businesses are also forced to adjust. For example, in some areas, such as college towns like Iowa City, music stores selling audio CDs are harder to find since many younger people are downloading their music. By early 2008, Apple had sold over 4 billion song downloads through the iTunes online music video and media store. In fact, now you can store music, photographs, feature films, homemade videos, books, correspondence, and other personal items in computers, which take up very little space. And I'm just going to point out here, I have a couple of iPhones here on the desk. And quite coincidentally, today is the day that Apple launched their next generation of iPhone, which is faster and, of course, has some new features and all of that, and GPS built in. But I often refer to the iPhone as kind of a symbol of where things are going in the convergence of technologies and the miniaturization of technologies. So what had taken literally rooms in my 2,000-square-foot home for the books, for the videos, for the music CDs, for the television set, for the entertainment center, all of that now fits in, you know, in my shirt pocket. So that's pretty significant. You know, it's not that I'm doing without. It's just, you know, honey, I shrunk the house. You know, I mean, everything is smaller. So I'll continue. For some people, the pocket-size video iPod or iPhone or similar device has replaced the television, photo album, and stereo system. Documents are available in electronic form, or if printed, can be scanned and stored in electronic form. These developments, which have kind of happened over the last 5 years, these developments have made it possible to downsize without getting rid of what we care about. Once documents are in digital form, they're much easier to move around, sort, organize, copy, backup, and search. For example, a software program called Paperport, included with auto-feeding Visioneer scanners, will quickly scan in all of your receipts and other paperwork, read it, index it, and then allow you to quickly search through thousands of on-screen pages. Trying to find that receipt from last year, simply type in the name of the merchant or any uniquely identifiable information on the receipt, and it'll come up instantly on the screen. Another factor contributing to the shrinking of our lives into digital form is convergence. Several pieces of equipment merged into one device. The notebook computer is an example of this. And something typically less than 1 inch thick is a complete computer system with keyboard, display, and processor. And as I said, plays videos and movies, and we listen to the radio and watch TV. Another example of convergence that we're most of us familiar with is the popular all-in-one printer, scanner, copier, and fax machine. Many of these come with memory card readers for digital cameras as well. So machines that used to take up significant amount of space on the desktop are now combined into one multifunctional device, not much bigger than a small microwave oven or bread box, if you remember what that is. In addition to convergence, we're seeing smaller devices. When convergence meets miniaturization, something really amazing happens. On June 29th, 2007, Apple introduced their iPhone Pocket Computer. Even though they call it a phone, I refer to it as a computer because it does email and internet, and it's a camera. It does everything. which combines numerous areas of life into a pocket-sized device. Email, telephone, internet, pager, camera, telephone, book, calendar, weather report, contacts, maps, GPS, now as of today, GPS systems, television, audiobooks, radio, movies, music videos, music, photographs, and more, all in your pocket. As of early 2008, the system became available with 8 gigabytes of storage, which means there is now, within your pocket, you can store over 10,000 pages of text. For me, the iPhone does about 90% of what I need to do on a computer. So when I'm at home, the pocket-sized device replaces an entire room full of equipment. I still use a notebook computer for video production, audio, editing, and website design. However, my other daily tasks are easily done on the smaller, more efficient, and more reliable iPhone. By January 2008, over 4 million iPhones had been sold in about 6 months, an average of 20,000 purchased per day. The price for smaller products is also shrinking. The computer manufacturer Asus offers the 2-pound EPC notebook for about $400. The system runs on a Linux operating system rather than Microsoft Windows. And to learn more, you can do a Google search on Asus EEPC or go to eeepc.asus.com. And, you know, as time goes by, some of these links may be dated, but I try to sort of introduce some of these ideas here. And another example of the drop in price was in August of last year, the iPhone was $600. A few months later, it was $400, and now their new phone's $200. So there's such a rapid price drop that consumers are actually complaining. You know, it's costing less. I'm upset. But that's how quickly prices are dropping, and things are just getting smaller and more powerful. The space-saving benefits of any single piece of technology by itself might not seem that significant. However, the collective use of a few gadgets and accessories can significantly reduce the living space a person needs. In the office, an all-in-one printer combined with a notebook computer can make it possible to run an entire business in a space about the size of a walk-in closet. And the chapter goes on with some practical examples of what can you do at home to simplify, organize, downsize. And the idea is to use less space, but also to use less time to take care of the administration of our life. How can these tools, rather than spending an afternoon on the phone with Dell technical support trying to fix things, once things are working the way they're supposed to, how can these tools serve us to free up time, to save us money, and simplify our life? I think we often see technology as something complicated and adding complexity to our life. But if done right, it can simplify our life. I'm going to read a short passage about, you know, how we think about our living area, living space. And the idea here is also, even though the book is written by, you know, from my perspective of living in 140 square feet, I've lived in 2,000 square feet before. I have friends that, a couple of friends of mine who live in 4,000 square feet. It's a two-bedroom home that's 4,000 square feet, if you can imagine that. So I want to, you know, have some ideas and suggestions that are practical to everybody and not just those who are thinking about living in a 10-by-7 house. Create a main living area. That's the heading here. Each person has varying degrees of conservation in mind when using water, electricity, heat, and air conditioning. So your results may vary. If you're currently in a large home or need to move into a large home for some reason and want to keep utility costs as low as possible, consider making a tiny home inside just one room of the larger home. Here's some examples of how you might do this. Make one room in your home the primary living space for working, eating, sleeping. Heat and cool only that portion of the home on a regular basis. By using smaller spot cooling and heating systems, you can cut down on costs dramatically. Purchase a small microwave oven and a small refrigerator to create a kitchenette for that room. So kind of, you know, what I've done with my small house, you can recreate that sleeping area, kitchen area, study area. And for larger homes, 3,000-4,000 square feet, if you can downsize within your home, that can be a considerable savings of time and energy. If necessary, remove existing windows. This would be in an older home, for example. Only in that room of the home that you're going to be spending most time in, and replace them with the most high-efficiency windows as possible. This can further help make that room the most energy-efficient one in the house. During severe heat or cold, maintaining a comfortable temperature in that one room rather than the entire house can save energy. And there's some more examples of how, you know, you don't have to make such a dramatic change, but you can start more effectively living in the space that you have. And I talk through the book, throughout the book, I bring up this theme about dieting and putting your life on a diet and budgeting. And I talk about budgeting and dieting in different areas. When we think of a budget, we often think of finances. But anyone who's familiar with Weight Watchers, is there anybody in here who's familiar? I'll raise my hand. I'm not shy. Okay, so it's a good organization. And they bring this idea of budgeting to your eating, you know, that you have a budget every day of what you're going to eat, and you manage that budget. So just the simple act of going through that, they have points, you count points. The simple act of going through that process gets you thinking about, you know, the limited resources at hand, and it just heightens your awareness about that. And I think for many people, then you begin to think about your money that way. You think about your time that way. And I bring that up in the book, that we can think about our space as well. You know, that we have a budget of hours in the day, of dollars in our monthly income, of, you know, calories that we're eating, and of space in our home. And to just not spend too much time on it, but just maybe sit down in an afternoon and kind of write down on a piece of paper a little pie chart. How do you want to break up your time and your space? You know, you want to have a segment of your weekly schedule dedicated to fitness and exercise. That'd be a good idea. And the same in your home. Do you want to set aside some space in your home dedicated to exercise? So there's some overlap there. So this is page 22, livable space utilization. Some people fall into the trap of thinking that a larger house will cure their overcrowded home syndrome. This is similar to thinking that going on a crash diet to lose 10 pounds will solve weight problems over the long run. When people lose weight quickly without making permanent lifestyle changes to their diet and exercise, they typically gain the weight back. People who receive large financial windfalls may pay off their existing bills and debts, yet soon they have the same financial problems they had before. The same goes for selecting a bigger house. The problem may not be how much room you have, but how you utilize that space. Living within the boundaries of our physical space is like living within the boundaries of our financial income. The discipline and self-control required is the same for these two areas of life. When people move into a bigger house without examining their purchasing habits, or in parentheses, hoarding habits, the bigger house will simply fill up with stuff and they'll feel cramped again. For such people, no amount of space is ever enough. contentment inside can change how we feel about all things on the outside. And I list some examples then. And in each chapter of the book, the chapters end with what I call action points. So these are just a few simple of examples of, so often we'll read a book or we'll go to a conference or a, you know, self-help motivational conference or whatever. We'll go away feeling good and some ideas got presented, but then we're not, you know, writing, what are we going to do? I mean, starting tomorrow, what are we going to do? What are we going to put into our daily, weekly routine to put this stuff into practice? Because if we're not going to take action, then it's just a book we read and it never changed our life, you know? So each chapter then has these action points. And then at the end of each chapter, there are discussion questions to get us thinking. And it's a book not so much to tell people what to think and what to do. I don't have all the answers. I have all the questions. Okay. So, and it's these questions, hopefully. I don't have all the questions, actually. But I have some of the questions. And so these questions then get us thinking about coming up with our own creative solutions. It's like when you're going to school, teachers really want to teach you how to learn. They don't want to teach you information. They want you to learn how to get the information, you know. So that's what this book's about. And then finally, each chapter ends after the action points and these discussion questions. It's a blank page. And that's for you to begin. You know, the book isn't really complete. You know, you're going to maybe get this book tonight, and I'll tell you, the book has empty pages in it. Okay, so you have to get involved. You have to write down some things here. What are your dreams? What are your action points? What are you going to do to make it happen? So those were three concepts I really wanted in the book, and so I'm thankful to have those there. But anyway, those are some selections from the book. It gives you a little flavor of what's in there.
You're listening to Life from Prairie Lights with our guest tonight, Gregory Paul Johnson, reading from his book, Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned Living in 140 Square Feet. And Gregory, have you had people fill out that last part of the book and share ideas with you that you hadn't thought about?
You know what's fun is we live in the age when the book is this organic organism, you know, it takes a life of its own, and very much it becomes then a collective effort. I was sort of the primary writer here, but, you know, so many people were providing me input and feedback and experiences throughout my life that I drew on for this. And I'm starting to get emails now from people with questions. And I'm just, like, in the last couple of weeks, people that have read the book, and it's exciting to hear back from people. So if there's anybody listening or anyone here in the audience, you know, feel free to write me. When I write you back, it'll probably be in the form of a posting on the website, you know, to explore the answers to that question. And so the book in its current form will just continue to grow and expand on the website, which is the resourcesforlife.com, or if you just go to putyourlifeonadiet.com, it'll take you there.
Are there questions or comments for Gregory Johnson from the studio audience? He'll be glad to take questions. Hi.
Hi there. I don't really have a question, but I do have kind of my own personal, you know, input or thoughts on this listening. I was sitting here laughing to myself because so many times, and I'm sure there's other people here who have had this happen, so many times I'll be in the house and I look around and all of us are in sort of a 6-foot square space in the house. It's kind of like wherever you are, everybody's there, you know, and my grandkids will all be around me. It's like, you know, okay, this room is, you know, 12 by 14, but yet we're taking up this little teeny space. And I really don't think that we need as much space as we use. I know when my two daughters were younger, I lived in what now seems like a palace compared to Gregory's 140 square feet, but we lived in a 16 by 16 foot one room house. And it was probably one of the happiest times in my life at that time. It was just fabulous. It was out in the woods, and, you know, we spent a lot of time outside. And I think that is, you know, what I listen to this and I hear this, and I think, you know, it makes you get out and utilize what's out there, rather than just staying within your kind of four square walls or, you know, your home, that there's a lot to be said for, you know, using the least amount of space as possible. But I think we do that anyway, because I think we all just gather together.
Well, that's an interesting point in that for many years now that the generations have been moving away, for instance, from family and have taken their space in long distance. And now you're actually promoting or talking about something that brings people closer together.
I think, yeah, partly because of the way I grew up, I was always had an extended family around. My grandmother was always there. Either my maternal or paternal grandmothers were in my life all the time. And so to me, family was this extended group of people who were always around. And so I thought in terms of sharing resources rather than, I guess, the typical American individualistic, you know, I'm going to have my own everything and not even renting everything. I want to own it all. So for me, I grew up with that experience and enjoyed it. And then, yeah, I guess, brought it into my adult life.
There's several questions in the audience. Hi.
Yes. I was wondering, it seems as though from the 1940s on, houses have gotten bigger and bigger, and now we've got the McMansions. And builders will tell you, oh, they're only giving the public what they want. Is the small house movement growing, and is that just a segment of society fighting against this very forceful other element that wants to just put us in gigantic homes?
That's a good question. I don't think we're going to have a choice, you know. As gasoline prices continue to rise, I was hearing a story the other day about the housing crunch, particularly in the suburbs, where, you know, those homes are hard to sell because people know this is not downtown. You know, you're going to be driving to everything, and you could ride a bike, but it's going to take you an hour. So people are looking for smaller homes that are more, as like in Iowa City, mixed urban spaces where everything's within a short walk or bike ride. And because of these cost factors, I think people are going to start looking to smaller homes. I have friends in the realty market and who work in real estate, and I often hear that, you know, these larger homes that 3,000, 4,000 square foot homes will be on the market for years, you know. And these smaller homes go on the market and it's, you know, days or hours, and they're just snatched up because that's what people want. People want to spend less time on upkeep. They want to spend less money on heating and cooling. They want their life back. And they have more creative ideas than just putting money in a house, you know, which you think is appreciating. And maybe it is, but you're also investing a lot of money in maintenance and upkeep. So, you know, people want to put as little money as possible in a house that could get flooded, right? Could have tornadoes. I mean, we've seen this in Iowa City, you know. And it doesn't take too many Katrinas and these types of things for people to realize, I don't want to have my life savings tied up in this thing. I'm not even there. You know, I go to work and I'm with friends, and why am I putting, you know, $150,000, $200,000 in this thing that could just be snatched away from me? You know, so it's these kinds of things. And then seeing that connection between, you know, Mother Nature taking away these homes, and then, you know, is there a connection between our bigger carbon footprint and the impact on the environment? Some people say there is. So, yeah, there's just a lot of benefits to downsizing.
Another question.
Yeah, I had a question, Greg, and I don't know how it fits in. When you were talking about the community, you know, and I've noticed this in smaller cities. If you come from a larger city, you're really not hesitant to call a cab, to take a cab someplace if you don't have a car and you're not able to bike and you're not a biker, right? Yeah. But here there seems to be a mindset against, if you take a cab, you're doing something extravagant. Now, I don't work for any cab companies, but there is one cab company in Iowa City who has purchased more cabs that are more economical, and they're really trying to make an effort that way. Is there a future in a city like Iowa City for people who don't have a car and can't bike, for smaller cabs, and for people to get their mindset changed to use something like that? And does that benefit, or does that work toward a goal that you would have in mind?
Oh, that's wonderful. I wouldn't even have thought to mention that had you not reminded me. And yes, you know, there's so many cities where these kinds of things are being done. And before I get to the cab thing, I'll just mention along with that, there are cities where they're allowing small homes. It's not against the law. You know, they're allowing these smaller homes because they realize there aren't going to be these, you know, five families of five people. You're going to have singles and couples that just want to live in smaller spaces. And there are these cottage communities where you'll have maybe 10 little cabins, and then they share the washer dryer. They share the exercise equipment. There's one riding lawnmower instead of 10, you know. And we've seen a little bit of that here in Iowa City. Over at Saddlebrook, there's a big clubhouse that everyone uses, and then they have their smaller homes that they live in, but there's this larger space. So similarly, other communities are having alternatives. You know, there are cars that you can co-op and own, and there are these cars where you go and you just use the car for an hour, and certainly cabs. I called a cab the other day, and I'll just mention the name so there's a connection to it. It was a black and gold cab, and they come with this hybrid car, you know? And I said, when did you get the hybrid car? They're the only one in town that uses it so far. But, I see that happening, that not only is the cab going to be a choice, it's going to be these electric cars that are getting driven around. And, you know, you think a cab's expensive, try owning a car, you know? And in Iowa City, because you're not going to drive 100 miles a day here. I mean, my dad jokingly talks about driving his car 200 miles a year. But even for anyone else, I mean, how far are you going to go? Iowa City is just a few miles for most people. So you have this huge overhead of your insurance and your tags and the payments for the car and the maintenance. And it's cheaper to take a cab most of the time and use public transportation. We've got a great public transportation system here in Iowa City with Coralville Transit, Iowa City Transit. The cabs, of course, are even part of that, and the CAM bus, you know, so, and the paths that are here that make it really practical to ride a bike or walk. So, okay.
Yes, I'm visiting from California, where we depend on cars and money.
Mm-hmm.
I'm moving, I'm moving in, when I get back, I have 4 days to move into half of the space I have now. I'm a little panicked. I'm not really packed. So do you have any suggestions about the first thing to let go of? Any ideas about what you would start? What would you first start throwing out? Mm-hmm. I'm willing, but I don't know.
Something I share in the book is that, tribal cultures, but, you know, historically people would have objects would be like their history. You know, that thing would remind them of some event in the past, you know, that was significant. And we do that too. You know, there are things that we keep. I was helping someone recently clear out a storage facility that was close to the river when it was coming up, and we had to get those things out, and she was in New York City. So, you know, in clearing this out, we saw some of these things and, you know, an old guitar and some things that really do have so much value, you know, in your heart. It's your memories. It's your life. You know, these things are your life. And without those things, it's like those memories are gone, the pictures and such, things from college, you know. So do you part with them? You know, I don't think so. So one suggestion I've come up with is think about taking pictures of things that mean a lot to you, you know, because it's not the thing. I mean, you know, and when was the last time she played that guitar? You know, 30 years ago, but she wants to keep it. So, you know, but a picture of that old piece of furniture or that old music instrument or those things from high school, or scan in the high school yearbooks or whatever you can do to scan things, take pictures, keep those memories, and then, you know, part with those things and maybe find somebody who's going to use it, because maybe it's something you really haven't even used other than holding on to the memory, you know? Does that help? Good. Okay.
Two questions.
Yeah.
What was the hardest decisions you had to make in this process? And also, what about the facilities?
Yeah, the facilities.
What's your day-to-day life like?
My day-to-day life, you know, it all kind of became a connected, holistic picture for me, because as I started working on these solar power alternative energy worksheets, you write down what appliances you're going to have, and then how many watts they use, and then you know, how many wind generators or solar panels are you going to need, and how many batteries are you going to need. So if I held on to all these appliances that I was used to having before, I would have needed a lot of infrastructure to maintain those things. And the refrigerator, I mean, it needs to run all the time, even if there's no sun shining on your solar cells. So for that, I started looking at vegan living, you know, as an option, just because I could get by with a lot of just shelf storable foods, and certainly I could eat whatever I want when I'm downtown, but I thought vegan living was kind of an interesting option. So I considered just the energy that goes into, for example, delivering a hamburger, you know, as a meal. Some friends of mine, we went to visit a packing plant over in Postville, Iowa, you may have heard about. And I'm, as a vegetarian, for a lot of reasons, that was an upsetting experience. But I wanted to see what was going on there because I'd heard about it. And that's a totally other story altogether. But what I realized was there's a lot of energy that goes into, raising these cows and feeding these cows and putting them on these semi-trucks and then taking them to the slaughterhouse and then all the machinery and equipment and energy, the thing's running 24 hours a day, and then you have to, it's going to rot if you don't freeze it. So you have to refrigerate this meat, and then you have to take it to the grocery store where it needs to continue to be refrigerated, and then you take it to your home where it continues to need to be refrigerated, and then you can't eat a raw, chunk of meat, so you have to cook it. It's this amazing, if you really sit back and think about it, this amazing sort of assembly line of energy, even if you don't care about, the animal so much or your health or whatever. It's just a lot of energy. And I thought, if I can just go to the farmer's market and get some fresh food and take it home, and it's going to be good for a few days, we don't need the semi-trucks, we don't need the packing plants, we don't need the gas grill, we don't need the refrigerator, we don't need all that stuff. I can just eat this fresh food. It's better for me. It's better for the environment. It's better for the animals, So I tried to make some of these decisions that allowed me to live simpler, using less energy, in a smaller space. And then as far as the utilities, I've told people before that, I might like to have some electricity and some water, a shower, a bathroom. The city, and many cities, I won't pick on Iowa City, but most cities then, for me, would prevent that. It's illegal for me to have electricity. It's illegal for me to have a toilet. It's illegal for me to have, an electric power hooked up to my house because the house isn't, 20 feet wide by 7 feet deep. So I'm stuck. And also, it's illegal for me to set this house on the ground. If I do that, I'm breaking, 1,000 codes. If I lift the house up 2 feet and put it on a trailer, everybody's happy. In fact, the city of Iowa City, many of the people from the city planning office came to the first open house, which was 5 years ago, and they said, what a beautiful home. But so, as far as answering your question then, these utilities, I'd like to have a house maybe that was 11 feet by 10 feet or whatever. I had to fit it on a trailer that could be pulled down the road. I'm limited by the current laws that we face. So, and also I had in mind the idea of, even though it's called a hermitage, which implies, going off in solitude, I really do like being outgoing and interacting with people. So the shower I use, you asked about my daily routine. I get up at 5 in the morning. Usually I try to do some yoga, meditation, go to the gym. By 8 o'clock, I've kind of started my day. And the shower, I use the shower at the gym, so I'm not showering at home. And the restroom, it's throughout the day. I'll use a restroom at work or, around town, wherever I happen to be. So I don't spend a lot of time at home. Yeah.
So you really are outsourcing.
Yes.
we have not a lot of time, but I wanted to get Dad in here because,
okay.
Dad, did you ever think that your son would take your vision and go with it like he has gone?
Oh, he has a way of going at his own speed in wonderful places. I had no idea he was going to do with computers what he's done either, you see. So now I come to him for advice.
Okay. And here's another question.
I had two quick questions. First of all, I write poetry, and the word for stanza comes from the word for room. And I just wonder, during your writing of the book, if use of the page or trying to limit pages because it's paper influenced your writing at all, if you kind of use those same restrictive lifestyle when you're writing or not.
Yeah, I have the pleasure or luxury or whatever of having this website and a newsletter that I've sent out for the last 8 to 10 years. And something I've tried to do is not feel compelled to produce, even if it's an electronic form. I just don't want to clutter people's inboxes. If I have something meaningful to say, I'll share it. Sometimes I'll send out a newsletter and it's a paragraph long. Nothing happened this month. And that's fine. I think, we get so used to in typical journalism or even, printing a book, oh, it has to be this length. We need to come out with more news. Well, sometimes there isn't any news, Sometimes we need to just sit and relax. But, we constantly have this information put in front of us, and journalists are out there trying to find some new news. Forest Street. So with the book, I just let it grow on its own, take its own shape and form and length, and I did sort of like a bonsai book, kept it trimmed back, you know, so that it was very, very fresh and rich rather than too wordy.
Yes, thank you for your inspiration and your idealism. It's the idealism, and it's related to the poet and to your own work, writing books. And we're in this wonderful room filled with books, and they probably could all be digital, and they aren't. Mm. So how do you justify or how do you rationalize your idealism of minimalizing in even just one little area called books?
Books shouldn't be digitalized. No, I have, because my house is small, I have small books, and I just, just for the fun of it, I went and bought, you know, these books that are sort of 3 inches tall. I have a whole, you know, library of these tiny books. There's something really for me, even though, like I say, my life has been technology. I've grown up with it. I'm always trying to have the latest. I mean, I don't rush out. You know, iPhone came out today. I'm not going to rush out and get that. I'm going to wait till tomorrow. But at the same time, you know, the book is fascinating. People joke about this, but I'm serious. You know, it doesn't crash. It doesn't have an operating system. I mean, you get this like instant access to information. It's low power. I mean, I can light a candle, read a book. I'm not plugged into anything, you know. And there's just something really nice about holding a book and reading a book, and going back over it. And anyway, long live the book.
The perfect environmental conscientious activity.
Just wondering how you came up with the title, Life on a Diet. It sounds powerful.
Thank you. And I wish I could claim full credit for that. We were throwing around about 10 titles for this book, and I came up with 9 of them. Anyway, and Gibbs Smith, although essentially the entirety from the inside of the cover to the back cover, inside is all my writing, they came up with the title. And what was really fascinating in this process was we were back and forth exchanging my book in text form with no formatting, no color, no pictures, nothing. It was just text. And in the final days of publishing, they went through and just did a fabulous job at picking the colors, the page layout, which I'm familiar with and I could do, but they did that. And I think they did a great job with it. And the idea of the title, because it does talk about putting our life on a diet, limiting in so many ways. But anyway, the title came up as a result of having a good publisher.
Hi. I'm not clear on where you do park your wonderful home. Where do you keep it? Do you store it?
Sitting right behind you is my dad. And one day I said, Dad, I have an idea, and I wonder if I could have a house parked in your yard. So,
well, you've certainly given us a lot to think about, Gregory Johnson. Thank you so much for giving us an idea of making life much more simple for everyone. Your book, Put Your Life on a Diet, Lessons Learned Living in 140 Square Feet. Setu Vora engineered live from Prairie Lights. I'm Julie Englander, and please let's thank Gregory Paul Johnson for the evening. Good night.